information is free.
The law?
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
We care. Appear to border and it shows.
The law?
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Attention, attention, attention. American forces are here to help. Remain calm. We will not tolerate civil disobedience. Attention, attention, attention. American forces are
just killing Americans in concentration camps. You have a home.
You're telling me that you're going to make some terrorist thing just to steal some money out of Congress?
Their arrest was only the beginning.
We are being lied to by
the government. They were innocent. They have no idea what they're up against.
This threat was very real, but at no point was the public ever in danger. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 197 of Media Monarchy. It's December 3rd, 2010, and my name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com, your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. This week, watch us explode with the Portland Patsy tree bomber and homegrown error. We've got color-coded propaganda and Cablegate updates, Econo crash news purge, Picasso, Oswald's coffin, and the Chasen case. All that and so much more is here on December 3rd, 2010, episode 197 from MediaMonarchy.com.
We'll be right back.
The Polyphonic Spree. Watch Us Explode. That's from their, at this point, last album, 2007's The Fragile Army. And it's 2010, the year we make contact. It's December 3rd, ladies and gentlemen, and this is the 197th episode of Media Monarchy. Once again, my name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com, your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. Coming to you live, as always, in sight and sound from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Time. Simulcast worldwide, thanks to ZeroPointRadio.com, as well, 92.3 FM and 1670 AM in Casper, Wyoming. Again, thanks to ZeroPointRadio.com. Of course, the worldwide home of free speech, RevereRadio.net. We also thank Free Radio Olympia, FROlympia.org, 98.5 FM in Olympia, Washington, Berkeley Liberation Radio.net on 104.1 FM in Berkeley, California, OneSkyRadio.com on 90.7 FM in Kisilov, Alaska, StickAM.com/Ground Zero Radio in Canton, Georgia, 89.9 FM Patriot Radio in La Mesa, Texas. And again, thanks to my man Glenn at kboo.info, that's kboo.info, and Jeff at radio23.org for rehosting the high-quality downloads and episodes from MediaMonarchy.com. If you are an independent alternative media outlet, website, radio show, video, anything, and you want to replay the shows, you don't have to ask. It's all public domain. It's all open source. I just ask that you play the high-quality version so it sounds good if you're re-streaming it. We should get reacquainted on Facebook.com/Media Monarchy, as well as MySpace, Twitter, YouTube, Ustream, and we are broadcasting and streaming live video of this episode 197 live, again on this December 3rd morning, 2010. You can buy a nice Media Monarchy t-shirt at cafepress.com/Media Monarchy. And again, we always implore you to send us news tips via MediaMonarchy@gmail.com or on Skype, Instant Messenger, iTunes, RadioForAll.net, Archive.org. Tons of ways to get the information, to share the show, to comment, to reach out, to help learn and grow, and that's why we're all doing this. Truth is stranger than fiction, and the things going down in the real world are far more fascinating than the shadows on the wall in the tabloid world that they tell us is important. If you find the show important, if you find the information valuable, I don't get rich off of this. I do it because it's a passion. But you could hit the donate button at the top of MediaMonarchy.com. Your support helps keep alternative media going. Paying for the domain names, the P.O. box, the DJ dues. I had to pick up a new mixer. I bought one used from a nice used music store here in Portland called Trade Up Music. All those things. A new microphone for the studio here. All those things need that little bit of dough, and again, it's greatly appreciated. Huge thanks to Robert in Hillsboro, Oregon, for his donation. And a huge thanks, and it was such a generous donation, and I feel like such a jerk for not getting the name down correctly, but I think it's Patrice in Iowa, and that may not be exactly correct, but you know who you are, and I apologize for not getting your name correct, and I send you a huge thanks. As we like to do, look at the breaking news again on this December 3rd morning. Oh, golly, the Obamasiah makes a surprise visit to his Afghanistan surge. President Barack Obama slipped unannounced into Afghanistan today, days before an important review about the conflict that has already lasted over 9+ years. Meeting up with his good buddy Karzai from UNICAL and, of course, his brother, running most of the major drug ops out of Afghanistan. Of course, that's what the wars are about. Gold, oil, and drugs. You got to get those poppies. You got to keep that heroin moving. November jobs report, surprise, surprise, unemployment rate is up. Meanwhile, the battle over Don't Ask, Don't Tell rages on. Meanwhile, Licky Weeks. I like that. That's good. WikiLeaks founder says guards against death threats. And, of course, we're going to get into Cablegate story. Oh, my gosh. Black Crowes are performing for quite possibly the very last time in Portland tonight. That and all those other things are all on the front of Google News, and we, of course, like to keep an eye peeled, as disgusting as that image is, to see all the things that are going on. It's always interesting when news spills out on a Friday. You got to wonder if that's timed to limit damage. So again, here we are. Another week goes by. Last week's episode, I hope you guys enjoyed. We had our in-studio guest, H. Michael Sweeney of ProParanoidPress.com, and we discussed the TSA and Star Whackers and security technology and all kinds of things. And wouldn't you know it, later that night, massive news happens, putting our own little Portland here on the worldwide stage in the phony war of terror charade. And I probably don't have to tell you, and longtime listeners would probably expect that this coverage was coming, me being in Portland, Oregon, and me tracking false flag intelligence operations meant to pacify, agitate, desensitize all levels of the public from us slaves, or civilians, as we're now called in the military jargon. So we have a lot to go over in the tree bomber case. So we're going to start it with an article from Kurt Nimmo, and the headline says it quite plainly, "Clueless Patsy set up by FBI in Christmas tree bombing plot. They not only hate us for our freedom, but also for our Christmas trees." Or at least that's what the FBI and the cops in Oregon would have you believe. The FBI thwarted an attempted terrorist bombing in Portland's Pioneer Courthouse Square before the city's annual tree lighting Friday night, November 26th, the anniversary of Mumbai and Black Friday. A Corvallis man, thinking he was going to ignite a bomb, drove a van to the corner of the square at Southwest Yamhill and 6th and attempted to detonate it. Muhammad Osman Muhammad. And there we have the double name, a la Sirhan Sirhan, and of course the middle name, Osman, which is reportedly Osama bin Laden's cover name, Tim Osman, when he was visiting the States in the 90s. But continuing. Muhammad Osman Muhammad, 19 years old, a Somali-born U.S. citizen, had a little help from the FBI. The arrest was the culmination of a long-term undercover operation during which Muhammad had been monitored for months as his alleged bomb plot developed. In a repeat of a now quite familiar pattern, the FBI told Muhammad they were building the bomb. They went so far as to travel to a remote spot in Lincoln County, Oregon, where a bomb concealed in a backpack was detonated as a trial run for the upcoming Christmas tree attack. The FBI eagerly assisted their clueless mark when he decided to shoot a video explaining his half-witted act. Muhammad and the FBI operative agreed to meet in Portland, where Muhammad allegedly told the FBI operative that he had written articles that were published in Jihad Recollections, an online magazine that advocated holy war against American infidels and assorted Christmas revelers. Mr. Muhammad's mentally disturbed fantasy, fueled by the FBI, is reminiscent of the Christmas Day non-bombing attributed to Nigerian Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, who is said to plan to take down an airliner over Detroit in spectacular fashion by igniting his underwear. According to this FBI affidavit, Muhammad's absurd bomb plot began in August 2009 when he contacted by email an unknown associate overseas said to be involved in terrorist activities. In December 2009, while the mysterious associate was in a frontier province of Pakistan, Muhammad and the associate discussed the possibility of Muhammad traveling to Pakistan to participate in violent jihad. Pakistan's intelligence service, the ISI, is notorious for creating and running jihad terrorist groups under the supervision of the Central Intelligence Agency. In late 2009, General Ahmad Shuja Pasha, general director of the ISI, presented CIA boss Leon Panetta with, quote, some highly classified and irrefutable evidence, end quote, that the mega snoop agency is involved in creating and running supposed terror groups in Pakistan. The proof about instances of covert U.S. support to some hardened militant outfits and terrorist activities they carried out over the past few weeks and months were presented to Panetta, so reports the Pakistan Observer. CIA effort to construct a Muslim terrorist archetype emerged following the Soviet-Afghan War, a multi-billion dollar effort that was part of a CIA covert agenda initiated during the Carter administration by then National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski. The CIA operative Osama bin Laden, a.k.a. Tim Osman, would serve as a model for all Islamic terrorists and demented suicide bombers to come. It's interesting to note that Mr. Muhammad's middle name is Osman. Muhammad was clueless right up until the moment he pressed a button on his cell phone. He thought this would blow up the Portland Christmas tree and kill infidels, but instead, it brought in the cops. Yelling, Allah Akbar, Arabic for God is great, Muhammad tried to kick agents and police after he was taken into custody, according to The Independent Online. Muhammad, a naturalized U.S. citizen living in Corvallis, was charged with attempted use of a weapon of mass destruction, which carries a maximum sentence of a life in prison. A court appearance happened Monday. He pled not guilty. We're interjecting that into this article that was published on the 27th. The threat was very real, says Arthur Balazan, a special agent in charge of the FBI in Oregon. Our investigation shows that Muhammad was absolutely committed to carrying out an attack on a very grand scale. There's no shortage of psycho nutcases absolutely committed to maiming and killing large numbers of people. Very few of them, however, are particularly useful for governments determined to keep the terrorist swindle going for as long as possible. The global war of terror mill needs a constant stream of patsies and dimwits to keep the charade in motion. It takes a special kind of patsy, one capable of actually deluding himself into believing they're jihadists in Pakistan who believe blowing up Christmas trees in Portland makes logistical sense in the war against the great Satan. One stupid enough to believe FBI agents are Islamic terrorists and the chimera known as Al-Qaeda is actually a global terror organization instead of a ruse named after the Mujahideen database. Clueless patsy. Set up. Yet another set up. And again, that's the article just from the second day. That would be the Saturday after the Blackjack Friday night. So my main posting on MediaMonarchy.com is under my headline, Portland Tree Bomber Plot Brings Homegrown Terranoia to Oregon. And I repost an article from The Oregonian. And this is the piece that we go over on the latest episode of NewWorldNextWeek.com. So I won't reread this text. However, this is the main site where I've been adding the updates, or the main post where I've been adding the updates. And I put together a compilation of clips from all around the world. Yes. This was the event that put our town on the world stage for the last week. I found that folks that I talked to either knew about it, thought it was kind of shady, or had no idea. I did have one guy that I talked to at work who was ex-military, who said he lived through 9/11 and completely buys the entire War of Terror scam. Just have to plant seeds. So before we get to my compilation of clips that I think will put this into greater perspective, if you haven't quite wrapped your brain around it, again, I don't want to take for granted my knowledge of the situation again because it's right here and breeze through it. I want you guys to follow along. And again, some folks listen to the show and I think some folks just check out the website. Of course, they go best together. And it's all laid out. And again, I put all the links, good, bad, left, right, independent, corporate media, all there to just flesh out the story. So let me run down the list of some of the other sources, and again, to show you how massive a story this was. on manufactured jihad at the Pioneer Courthouse Square. We have the aforementioned Oregonian. We also have KVAL, who we'll hear a clip from. We've got, of course, NationalTerrorAlert.com, our own CoinLocal6.com, which listeners may recall back in September when we did our 9/11 Commission book burn. KOIN Local 6 here in Portland was the only media outlet to come out and cover myself and Clyde Lewis of GroundZeroMedia.org burning the 9/11 Commission report in response to the hysteria surrounding the Quran burning on the 9th anniversary of 9/11. We have reporting from our own PortlandMercury.com. Lots of videos. NECN.com. And more. FBI thwarts its own car bomb from activistpost.com. Feds plant inert bomb in Portland before arresting Muslim man. That's a great piece from salemnews.com. And we just read the patsy set up by the feds from Kurt Nemo. FBI apparently set up U.S. teen blamed for fake car bomb. That's from Raw Story. And then the Sunday morning after that Friday, there was a fire at an Oregon Islamic center that had been attended by Osman. No injuries, and we'll get a little bit of that in our compilation clip coming up. We have more on that from CNN's Belief blog. We also have deputies investigating an assault on a Muslim inmate in a Portland jail. Again, a possible connected hate crime. And we'll try and get at who the real hate criminals are. Friends and defense say teenage Portland patsy set up by the FBI. Arrest of former OSU student stuns friends. That's from GazetteTimes.com. Christmas tree bomber in touch with Al-Qaeda, so says ABC. And the story we're going to go through after our compilation comes from the great Glenn Greenwald. But we also have the FBI celebrates it prevented FBI's own bomb plot. That's from TechDirt.com. Paul Craig Roberts on fabricating terror, asking the question, will Portland rejoin the Joint Terrorism Task Force? And we'll even try and learn a little bit about the Portland 7. So strap in, here's the compilation clip of the Portland tree bomber plot bringing homegrown paranoia to Oregon.
The Christmas lights go on in Portland, Oregon. The residents unaware they were being targeted by a deadly terror plot. That's according to the U.S. authorities, who say a Somali-born teenager was planning to attack the crowd with a car bomb. 19-year-old Mohammed Osman Mohamud was allegedly caught in a sting operation, given a fake explosive device by FBI agents. He's said to have told them he wanted to wage violent jihad. Mohamud set to appear in a federal court on Monday, charged with attempting to use a weapon of mass destruction. If convicted, he faces life behind bars.
Could a holiday tree lighting ceremony have been the latest target for terror? This is a look at Portland, Oregon's Christmas tree Friday night. The FBI says just as thousands of people were gathered in the area of the tree for the lighting ceremony, this man, Mohammed Osman Mohamud, dialed a cell phone that he thought would trigger explosives in a van parked nearby. In fact, he was already being watched by the FBI, and the bomb was a fake set up by authorities. He was arrested a short time after dialing the phone. An FBI affidavit says the attack was planned for months, and at one point, a practice bomb was detonated in Oregon's backwoods. Mohamud allegedly told agents at one point, "Since I was 15, I thought about all this. It's going to be a fireworks show. A spectacular show." Mohamud is 19 and is a naturalized U.S. citizen who lives in Corvallis. He's been charged with attempted use of a weapon of mass destruction. He'll appear in court on Monday.
And Mayor Sam Adams released a statement shortly after last night's arrest, thanking investigators for all their efforts. A portion of his statement reads, quote, "A smart federal, state, and local law enforcement investigation caught a criminal tonight bent on mass destruction and murder in our city. The bomb was a fake, but evidence shows the criminal who tried to detonate it was real." And joining us live now from the Portland Police Department, Sergeant Pete Simpson with more on last night's arrest. Thank you so much, Sergeant, for joining us this morning. Now, we know this was a federal operation, but we want to know, when did Portland police become aware of this plot and how exactly did they respond to it?
Well, the police bureau became involved in the investigation a few months ago at the request of the FBI. The police bureau supplied some investigators and investigative assistants to the FBI throughout the investigation, and as well as officers for the arrest in last night's incident.
And Sergeant, tell us about the security measures that you had in place last night for the tree lighting ceremony, and will there be changes in place for the future for other holiday events coming up?
Well, last night the police presence downtown was pretty standard for the tree lighting ceremony. Lots of officers helping citizens, crowd management and directing traffic and things like that. As you said, the bomb was a fake or an inert explosive device. There was no danger to the public of it going off or anything like that, so there was no additional security measures around that. But the federal authorities coordinated the response last night with the police bureau to make the arrest. As far as the future goes, you know, we'll see. There'll be a little more police presence downtown. We want to make sure people understand that it is safe downtown with the holidays and everything. It's certainly going to rattle some nerves to have this happen here.
Now, we also wanted to ask you, the suspect said Portland was a good target because no one would expect it to happen here. Is terrorism a focus for Portland police, and is this going to be changing your policies?
Well, it's always a focus. It's not something that has been forgotten about what happened on 9/11, and I think that the suspect's statement speaks volumes about the safety the citizens feel in Portland. I mean, we are one of the safest cities in the United States, and people should believe they're safe in Portland because they are. This gentleman, somewhat of an anomaly, but it does speak volumes to the feeling of security citizens have. We think about these things happening in New York or London or Madrid or Moscow or some other place other than Portland, but it is proof that people need to remain vigilant, and the threats are real, and this case proves how close and how dangerous this individual was, and thankfully he was intercepted by investigators and never made a connection with real people here to carry this plot out.
As we've seen, it can happen anywhere. Well, thank you so much, Sergeant Simpson, for joining us this morning, and thank you to your law enforcement officers too, who helped bring him into custody. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
This is a Fox News alert from New York. I'm Marianne Rafferty. Federal agents arresting a Somali-born teen late Friday. The feds and local police arrested Mohammed Osman Mahmoud after he tried to detonate what he thought was a car bomb at a Christmas tree ceremony in downtown Portland, Oregon. Agents say the device wasn't real and it had been supplied by undercover agents as part of a sting. The Oregon U.S. attorney says they have no reason to believe there is any continuing threat arising from the case. Mahmoud is expected to make his first court appearance on Monday.
Let me set the stage for you. It was about a year ago. Four men apparently tried to bomb synagogues and shoot down planes in New York State, except there was no kaboom. The bombs and the Stinger missile they allegedly tried to use to sink the plane were duds, and they were slapped with silver bracelets. Now there's talk not only were the weapons duds, but the accusation of them being terrorists is a dud as well. Joining us now, not a dud, but a radio host, Jason Vermes. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Vermes. So give us the details about this. This might be all dead. This might be a bit of a setup. Can you explain to us just a little bit more?
Absolutely. Well, once again, we have the FBI coming in and actually creating a terror group. In fact, the only weapon that was ever recovered was brought in by the FBI, and it was a handgun. And this is very similar to what happened in 1993 with the original World Trade Center bombing. We had an Egyptian army officer, Ahmed Salam, recruited by the FBI to create a group. And in fact, he was the one that not only created the bomb that went off in the World Trade Center in 1993, but it was supervised by both the FBI and the district attorney. So we see this again and again and again. In fact, during 9/11, two of the alleged hijackers actually lived with and rented from an FBI informant.
Okay, Mr. Vermes, a lot of people out there will probably say that your accusations are preposterous, but based on the information I've read, there's a lot of evidence saying that this might be the case. There's also an audio file of conversations between supposedly FBI and these accused men. Let's go and listen to that now.
It was built by supervision from the Bureau and the GA, and we was all informed about it, and we know that the bomb started to be built. By who? By your confidential informant. What a wonderful, great case.
Okay, so that's an audio file that could be evidence. That, I think, comes from your documentary. But then also, there is a little bit more evidence besides just that. Can you speak on that a little bit more for us?
Absolutely. You can find this information in my newest documentary, Invisible Empire, A New World Order Defined, over at Infowars.com. What you were just listening to was that Egyptian informant talking to his FBI handler, John Antisev. And again, we see this over and over and over again. These terrorists are not allowed to create these groups or do these attacks without this type of supervision. Even look at the underwear bomber. We now know from eyewitness testimony that he was brought on the plane by a sharp-dressed man who said that he didn't need a passport and that he was a Sudanese refugee. How are all these terrorists getting through if it's not through organizations like the FBI and the CIA? It seems like when the average Joe makes a report to the FAA, the CIA, the FBI, it's ignored. Why does that happen?
Mohammed Osman Mahmoud is expected to be in a Portland courtroom today on a charge of attempted use of a weapon of mass destruction. In recent months, people who know him say that Mahmoud's behavior changed. He dropped out of school and stopped attending mosque. He seemed on edge. On Sunday, his place of worship caught fire. The imam says he went once or twice a month. Investigators say the fire was arson.
We don't know if this was somebody who was walking past and started the fire or whether or not it is a targeted event.
Much of the mosque was burned. Qurans and wedding certificates were destroyed, and now the community is devastated.
I don't see difference between this and a terrorist act because they're causing terror.
It's a sad situation because what they're doing now is they're taking an individual and they're taking this individual's example and portraying it upon everybody.
The 19-year-old naturalized U.S. citizen was arrested Friday by federal agents, charged with plotting to set off a van full of explosives at a Portland Christmas tree lighting.
I didn't think he would ever do anything like that because he was a really nice kid.
An FBI affidavit said it was Mahmoud who picked the target of the bomb plot, that he was warned several times about the seriousness of his plan, that the bomb Mahmoud thought was real was actually a dud supplied by the feds.
We get a lot of training, we get a lot of information, intelligence updates constantly about things that may happen but don't.
I was going to let one 19-year-old punk kid bully me into not enjoying a beautiful, not raining Portland holiday day.
The FBI is determined to find out who burned the Corvallis Mosque and has established a tip line and a $10,000 reward.
Let me interrupt you because we're almost out of time.
Sure.
I know this is the point of real debate, which is from the affidavit that where's the balance between elements of the plot that were supposed to be his idea and what the FBI undercover agents who eventually befriended him, what they suggested?
Well, according to FBI officials, they gave him several other options along the way. They had been in contact with him since June of 2010, and they met in person. They emailed, they had emails with him, and these undercover federal informatives were, they say, were giving Mr. Mohammed several options, other options than this alleged bomb plot. They suggested, for example, that he finish his schooling and use that money to travel overseas in the future, or he could continue praying, etc. And each step of the way, they alleged that he was clear on being involved in an operational, having an operational participation in a violent jihad. Of course, his defense attorneys are going to work to challenge that and suggest that what FBI officials were doing was grooming him to participate in this plot.
Grooming him to participate in this plot. That was my compilation of clips detailing the Portland tree bomber patsy. And again, all those are linked up in the main story, all those videos and all the other articles. It's all laid out for you. But we're going to continue on this other side of the compilation of clips and take it from Glenn Greenwald. The FBI successfully thwarts its own terrorist plot. The FBI is obviously quite pleased with itself over its arrest of a 19-year-old Somali-American, Mohammed Osman Mohammed, who, with months of encouragement, support, and money from the FBI's own undercover agents, allegedly attempted to detonate a bomb at a crowded Christmas event in Portland, Oregon. Media accounts almost uniformly trumpeting the event exactly as the FBI described it. Loyalists of both parties doing the same, with Democratic Party commentators proclaiming that this proves how great and effective Democrats are at stopping those evil terrorists, while right-wing polemicists point to this arrest as yet more proof that those menacing Muslims sure are violent and dangerous. What's missing from all of these celebrations is one iota of questioning or skepticism. All the information about this episode, all of it, comes exclusively from an FBI affidavit filed in connection with a criminal complaint against Mohammed. As shocking and as upsetting as this may be to some, FBI claims are sometimes one-sided, unreliable, and even untrue, especially when such claims as here are uncorroborated and unexamined. That's why we have what we call trials before assuming guilt or even before believing that we know what happened. because the government doesn't always tell the complete truth, because they often skew reality, because things often look much different once the accused is permitted to present his own facts and subject the government's claims to scrutiny. The FBI affidavit, as well as whatever its agents are whispering into the ears of reporters, contains only those facts the FBI chose to include but omits the ones it chose to exclude, and even the facts that are included as merely are merely assertions at this point and thus may not be facts at all. It may very well be that the FBI successfully and within legal limits arrested a dangerous criminal intent on carrying out a serious terrorist plot that would have killed many innocent people, in which case they deserve praise. Court-approved surveillance and use of undercover agents to infiltrate terrorist plots are legitimate tactics when used in accordance with the law. But it may also just be as easily the case that the FBI, as they've done many, many times in the past, found some very young, impressionable, disaffected, hapless, aimless, inept loners, created a plot, it then persuaded, manipulated, and trapped him into joining, essentially turning him into a terrorist, and then patted itself on the back once it arrested him for having thwarted a terrorist plot, which, from start to finish, was the FBI's own concoction entirely. Having stopped a plot which itself manufactured, the FBI then publicly touts, and an uncritical media amplifies, its success to the world, thus proving that both domestic terrorism from Muslims is a serious threat, and the government's vast surveillance powers, current and future new ones, are necessary. There are numerous claims here that merit further security and questioning, rather scrutiny and questioning. First, the FBI was monitoring the email communications of this American citizen on U.S. soil for months at least, with what appears to be the flimsiest basis, namely that he was in email communication with someone in northwest Pakistan, an area known to harbor terrorists. Paragraph 5 of the affidavit. Is that enough to obtain court approval to eavesdrop on someone's calls and emails? I'm glad the FBI is only eavesdropping with court approval if that's true, but certainly more should be required for judicial authorization than that. Communicating with someone in northwest Pakistan is hardly reasonable grounds for suspicion. Second, in order not to be found to have entrapped someone into committing a crime, law enforcement agents want to be able to prove that, in the 1992 words of the Supreme Court, the accused was, quote, independently predisposed to commit the crime for which he was arrested, end quote. To prove that, undercover agents are often careful to stress that the accused has multiple choices, and they then induce him into choosing with his own volition to commit the crime. In this case, that was achieved by the undercover FBI agents allegedly advising Muhammad that there were at least five ways he could serve the cause of Islam: praying, studying engineering, raising funds to send overseas, or becoming operational. Muhammad replied he wanted to be operational by using an exploding bomb. But strangely, while all other conversations with Muhammad, which with the FBI summarizes, were, according to the affidavit, recorded by numerous recording devices, this conversation, the crucial one for negating Muhammad's entrapment defense, was not. That's because, according to the FBI, the undercover agent, quote, was equipped with audio equipment to record the meeting. However, due to technical problems, the meeting was not recorded, end quote. Paragraph 37. Thus, we only have the FBI's word and only its version for what was said during this crucial, potentially dispositive conversation. Also, strangely, the original New York Times article in this story described this conversation at some length and reported the fact that the meeting was not recorded due to a technical difficulty, but the final version of that New York Times article omitted that, instead simply repeating the FBI's story as though it were fact. Third, ample facts that call into question whether Muhammad's actions were driven by the FBI's manipulation and pressure rather than his own predisposition to commit a crime. In June, he tried to fly to Alaska to get a fishing job he obtained through a friend, but he was on the government's no-fly list. That caused the FBI to question him at the airport and then bar him from flying to Alaska and thus preventing him from earning income with a job. Having prevented him from working, the money the FBI then pumped him with, including almost $3,000 in cash for him to rent his own apartment, surely helped make him receptive to their suggestions and influence. And every other step taken to perpetrate this plot, from planning its placement to assembling the materials to constructing the bomb, was all done at the FBI's behest and with its indispensable support and direction. It's impossible to conceive of Muhammad having actually achieved anything on his own before being ensnared by the FBI. The only tangible action he had taken was to write three articles on fitness and jihad for the online magazine Jihad Recollections. At least based on what is known, he had no history of violence, no apparent criminal record, had never been to a training camp in Afghanistan, Pakistan, or anywhere else, and before meeting the FBI, had never taken a single step towards harming anyone. Does that sound like some menacing sleeper terrorist to you? At the end of the article, he adds the update about the arson, which we heard referenced in our clips. The mosque, sometimes attended by Muhammad, was victimized by arson, so the FBI didn't stop any actual terrorist plots, but they may have helped inspire one. Again, that's the great piece from Glenn Greenwald breaking down the Portland tree bomber with the part we wanted to shine light on, and that would be the crucial missing recordings central to this whole case. I did mention the great article on SalemNews.com. Feds plant inert bomb in Portland before arresting Muslim man. Police could have arrested the man sooner, but they took part in his suspected terrorist act. This article, fortunately, points out many things. That what if he was connected up to some other group? The compartmentalization within intelligence agencies. Sometimes the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. What if there was a simultaneous bomb set to go off at the same time? How do we know he couldn't have been working with a second group that law enforcement didn't know about? It goes on to mention British SAS soldiers arrested by Iraqi police dressed up as Arabs, and all the host of other false flag terror activities. We even grab an update from Google News this morning, December 3rd, Muslims react to terror suspect video. This is from KPTV, the exclusive cell phone video of terror suspect Muhammad Muhammad. Obtained by KPTV, features remarks about Americans that many Muslims said they found inappropriate regardless of the context. An unnamed source tells KPTV the video was taken on an iPhone on May 22nd in an Oregon State University dorm room. It is not known who the rant was directed toward, but the source said it followed some sort of confrontation. Quote, "You know what the whole West thing is? They want to insult our religion, they want to take our lands, they want to rape our women while we're bowing down to them. That's what they want." This could very well relate to the question I always ask, that even if you believe the official stories of 9/11 and the War of Terror, you would go back to the terrorists and they say, "We do this because you invade our lands." Even if you believe the official story. That's what it traces back to. Even if you believe the official story, you've got to know that it traces back to the Mujahideen and Brzezinski and Gates and Central Intelligence Agency and training and funding enemies. That's how the grand chessboard moves. That's how they play these games. Now, of course, had this story probably happened in some other city this week, I wouldn't give it this much coverage. Again, this is happening in my town of Portland, Oregon. But I think it's a good opportunity to flesh out some of those things we just fleshed out. Something we do on the latest NewWorldNextWeek.com episode is off the top of our heads, back and forth, name all of the famous phony terror busts of the last several years. That would include the New York Mosque bombers, which we heard Jason Burmes reference in our compilation clip just a little bit ago. And the World Trade Center event in 93 with John Antisev and Imad Salim. We've got the Hutery earlier this year. We've got the DC Metro earlier this year. And those are just the ones I can now remember off the top of my head. I think that this Portland tree bomber story again is important because I think it helps hit a lot of central and key issues. So that's why we've spent the time that we have here on episode 197 of MediaMonarchy.com. I had the great opportunity this past Sunday, so just 2 days after Blackjack Friday night, my good friend Clyde Lewis of GroundZeroMedia.org invited me on his show that's broadcast live on 100,000 watts on KUFO 101.1 FM here in Portland, Oregon. had me on for the full 2 hours in studio to discuss Blackjack Friday, the face of error, and we also discussed something Clyde calls commu numbers, and that would be numbers stations, something over the shortwave that you hear numbers announced, and they've been used since World War I era for spies. The story and meme has come back in that the Russian spies that were recently busted, Anna Chapman and the rest of them, they were using number stations. Everyone's favorite new video game, Call of Duty Black Ops, features number stations. And someone who had analyzed some number stations from a frequency in a station that hadn't broadcast in quite some time, someone claims, and again, I don't have this all off the top of my head, but I do have the articles on Ground Zero, Blackjack Friday, and Commu Numbers that link back to the full original pieces from groundzeromedia.org. That it had something more than be sure to drink your Ovaltine. It mentioned a North-South Korean situation, which we have, and it also mentioned some kind of attack on L.A., which we could speculate could be the mystery missile situation. And it also made reference to an assassination attempt on Medvedev. So I put this episode out from groundzeromedia.org through my own feeds and podcast servers. So again, if you subscribe, as you should, feeds.feedburner.com/mediamonarchy. Put that in your Google Reader. Put that straight into iTunes, and you won't miss a thing. You'll get all the audio, video, and even PDFs at times. So I put this episode out for folks to check out. And again, huge thanks to my friend Clyde for having me on, for giving me the opportunity, for having both of us go on and talk about the tree bomber 48 hours after it had happened to a mass amounts of audience, hopefully tens of thousands of people. And again, he's number one in his time slot on Sunday nights. I think that shows that people are hungry for something different on the radio. So again, even thanks to KUFO for carrying a show. I've made several references throughout today's shows to our latest episode of NewWorldNextWeek.com. We were on a couple-week hiatus while James did some important work behind the scenes, some of which will be manifesting itself very soon, I believe, on CorbettReport.com. But our latest episode for December 2nd, we go over, of course, the FBI tree bomber, the government versus internet, and the Food Safety Act. Government versus internet, grabbing domains, and the Food, quote-unquote, Safety Act. It is an act, and it's rigged. We go over both those on our previous episode, 196B. So again, newworldnextweek.com. Again, you can subscribe to that. You can get high-quality, low-quality MP3 versions. And yes, we're even working on transcripts. If someone out there, speaking of transcripts, stenographer, we would appreciate a stenographer for our regular Media Monarchy radio episodes. That would be quite the undertaking, as you would have to listen to all my ums and figure out what the hell I'm talking about. But if that interests you in the slightest amount, and again, we could use it for the YouTube videos that we shoot, and as we are shooting right now for Ustream and youtube.com/mediamonarchy, even transcriptions for those brief media clips would be appreciated. So again, mediamonarchy@gmail.com. We'll shift gears slightly as we move through all the other related news going on in our brave new world order, and we'll take it from the AFP. U.S. to drop color-coded terror alerts. And again, we note the timing of many of these events just as we're hitting TSA rage boiling point. We have the tree bomber, but meanwhile, we're getting rid of the ridiculous color-coded terror alerts. The United States is planning to replace its color-coded terror alert system drafted in the wake of September 11, 2001 attacks with detailed threat advisories, media reported Thursday. The Department of Homeland Security, DHS, has drafted a proposal sent to the White House to end its five-colored system, mocked by critics as a relic of post-9/11 frenzy that caused alarm without explaining the reason for the alerts. Instead, it will provide more clarity and guidance in specific alerts, according to the reports. Quote, the goal is to replace a system that communicates nothing with a system that communicates precise, actionable information based on the latest intelligence, end quote, a senior Homeland Stupidity official told The Washington Post and The New York Times.
10 years after it was introduced, the befuddling system of color-coded terror alerts is about to get scrapped. Since March 2002, the five-color palette has attempted to guide Americans on the likelihood of a terror attack, from low-risk green to severe-risk red. The problem is, too many have found it meaningless.
Well, I don't think anybody really pays attention to it anyways.
It's always, what, orange elevated?
Where are we at color chart-wise right now? we're yellow.
We're yellow, yes.
In fact, the national threat level has been stuck at yellow since 2006. That translates to significant, somewhere above guarded, and below high. Stuck at yellow before, during, and even after the underwear bomber attempt last Christmas.
It seems like it has been the same for a very long time.
It's not really clear, you know, what orange is versus yellow. Like, I mean, I don't know.
Critics say that it doesn't convey any real information to the public or to first responders who have to use that information.
It's much the same in Great Britain, where their system uses words like low risk to critical.
I don't really pay much attention to it.
The question is, what system would be better?
Well, I think an old-fashioned bell, to be honest with you. Woo-hoo-hoo, and then all of a sudden everyone knows it's a terrorist bomb.
The Washington Post quotes U.S. officials saying the new U.S. system could have just two threat categories, elevated and imminent, that would last no more than a week at a time.
When possible, the alerts would come with specific information on the nature of the threats. Today, Homeland Security would only tell us it's reviewing new recommendations with the goal of providing more clarity. Cheryl Atkinson, CBS News, at Reagan National Airport.
And of course, no one likes to call it Reagan. Doing away with the color codes. Gosh, what will they replace it with? I can hardly wait. Let's hit some of our related police state updates that are posted below our story about U.S. to drop color-coded terror alerts, and we'll take it from Paul Joseph Watson. Watchdog probes DHS spying on Drudge Report. A Freedom of Information Act request filed by former Congressman Bob Barr seeks to discover whether the Department of Homeland Stupidity has been keeping tabs on the Drudge Report and other prominent media outlets who have spearheaded a nationwide revolt against invasive TSA airport security measures. The FOIA request filed by Barr's Liberty Guard organization demands that the TSA, an agency of the DHS, turn over all information related to Matt Drudge, DrudgeReport.com, along with other media personalities and websites that have been at the center of the TSA controversy, including, of course, Alex Jones, John Tyner, and on and on. The request seeks to ascertain whether any of these names have been linked with the term domestic extremist, in reference to a recent TSA memo that was leaked last week, which, according to Doug Hagman, officially addresses those who are opposed to or engaged in the disruption of the implementation of the enhanced airport screening procedures as domestic terrorists. Oh, extremists, I'm sorry. Get my euphemistic language straight. Numerous confirmed memos originating out of the federal or state law enforcement agencies, such as the infamous MIAC report, have listed conservatives and libertarians as domestic extremists and even potential domestic terrorists for opposing big government and supporting constitutionally minded campaigns and causes. Government reports violations of limits on spying aimed at U.S. citizens. This is from the Washington Post, Spencer Hsu. The federal government has repeatedly violated legal limits governing the surveillance of U.S. citizens, according to previously secret internal documents obtained through a court battle by the American Civil Liberties Union. In releasing 900 pages of documents, U.S. government agencies refused to say how many Americans' telephone, email, or other communications have been intercepted under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, amendments of 2008, or to discuss any specific abuses, the ACLU said. Most of the documents were, of course, heavily redacted. However, semi-annual internal oversight reports by the offices of the Attorney General and Director of National Intelligence identify ongoing breaches of legal requirements that limit when Americans are targeted and minimize the amount of data collected. Hundreds of pages of documents have been released. Scant reporting on that, while we pay attention to the Cablegate extravaganza, which, again, we're going to get to in just a little bit. Our two other related police state updates. TSA now setting up Nazi-style Viper security checkpoints at bus terminals. That's from naturalnews.com and from a man, Jeff Long, at redactednews.blogspot.com, as well as rockcreekfreepress.com on Fatherland Security's next step, FAST, which we'll call Fascist Attribute Screening Technology. We noted over the last couple of weeks surrounding the TSA hysteria that ultimately they want to get you to choose the body scanners, and that also ultimately they may not really care because they're just going to do biometrics on us anyway. And they know we can only fight against so many things for so long before we'll ultimately lay down, GI. And we knew they were going to push it to planes, trains, and automobiles. That's why we made those overt references to planes, trains, and automobiles last week over Thanksgiving, Blackjack Friday. It's all an amazing stew. Let's move to some of our War Whores updates on occupations and electrodes. And we'll take it from allgov.com. U.S. presence in Afghanistan now longer than the Soviets' occupation. The United States has passed an unfortunate landmark. U.S. troops have now been stuck in Afghanistan longer than was the Soviet Union. As of November 26th, again, the aforementioned Blackjack Friday, Mumbai anniversary, the American military matched the length of time that the once mighty Red Army spent in Afghanistan, 9 years and 50 days. The Soviet occupation lasted from December 27, 1979 to February 15, 1989. The continuing U.S. campaign to rout the Taliban and al-Qaeda started on October 7, 2001. The Soviet army withdrew in defeat, having suffered more than 14,000 deaths and more than 50,000 wounded. By comparison, the U.S. involvement has been less costly. 1,403 Americans have died, although that number has been rapidly rising. Half of the U.S. deaths have been in the last 2 years, and about 7,000 Americans have been wounded. The latest Pentagon report on progress towards security and stability in Afghanistan paints a bleak picture of the current situation, with violence on the rise, corruption increasingly entrenched, and the Taliban gaining strength. Polls show that the majority of Americans have grown disillusioned with the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. Nonetheless, both President Barack Obama and the congressional leadership of the Republican Party are committed to keeping American troops in the country until at least 2014. You can get more on the story from AirForceTimes.com and the Christian Science Monitor, and I believe AllGov.com even has the link to download the full PDF report on progress towards security and stability in Afghanistan. Something I made reference to on my appearance on Ground Zero Sunday night with Clyde Lewis is that a lot of this traces back to Brzezinski and Gates training the Mujahideen to fight against the Soviets. I made reference to Brzezinski admitting to, I believe, La Nouvelle Observateur, that, of course, contrary to popular wisdom, we drew the Soviets in. That was the plan all along. The official story is, oh, the Soviets invaded, so we had to go do that. We had to start Charlie Wilson's war and all that other propaganda garbage. But the truth comes from the elites when they think we're not paying attention or we're not reading the books that they've written for their other elite bloodline cronies. I think some listeners disagreed on that, but Hopefully we can put it right back out there. Hopefully we can plant seeds to folks. And again, getting on that kind of media outlet is one great coverage for MediaMonarchy.com, but that's the small part of it, to hopefully plant seeds. That's the idea. Check out Brzezinski. Check out his admission that Han shot first, if you will. Posted along the bottom of this War Horrors, Occupations, and Electrodes, we unfortunately get to those electrodes. And we'll take it from rawstory.com. CIA implanted electrodes in brains of unsuspecting soldiers, suit alleges. A group of military veterans are suing to get the CIA to come clean about allegedly implanting remote control devices in their brains. It's well known that the CIA began testing substances like LSD on soldiers beginning in the 1950s, MK Ultra, MK Artichoke, MK Naomi, but less is known about allegations that the agency implanted electrodes in subjects. A 2009 lawsuit, and we do have the PDF for you to download, and you can read the claims that the CIA intended to design and test septal electrodes that would enable them to control human behavior. The lawsuit said that because the government never disclosed the risks, the subjects were not able to give informed consent. According to a 1979 book by former State Department intelligence officer John Marks, The CIA and the Search for the Manchurian Candidate, an internal 1961 memo by a top agency scientist reported that, quote, the feasibility of remote control of activities in several species of animals has been demonstrated. Special investigations and evaluations will be conducted toward the application of selected elements of these techniques to man. The CIA pursued such experiments because it was convinced the Soviets were doing the same thing. So says Jeff Stein of the Washington Post. In mid-November of this year, U.S. Magistrate Judge James Larson ruled that the CIA must produce records and testimony regarding the experiments conducted on thousands of soldiers from 1950 to 1975. The CIA has already claimed that some documents are protected under the state secrets privilege, but Larson said the agency needs to be more specific, with links to courthousenews.com. We have more on this from the aforementioned Jeff Stein on Spy Talk on the Washington Post. CIA brain experiments pursued in veteran suit. These things are very real. But the media tells you they're just entertainment. It's just a Matt Damon, Robert De Niro movie. It's just fiction. I watched a film called Hopscotch that's streaming on Netflix. 1980, Walter Matthau, CIA agent who gets bounced, who decides he's going to write a tell-all exposing all the spies and diplomats and intelligence agencies around the world. I think that's kind of timely and fitting for our WikiLeaks era. And of course, all the media and memes swirl about. Our last War Horrors, Occupations, and Electrodes note is a video from Raw Story and Raw Replay where Gates has been announcing and discussing the results of their Don't Ask, Don't Tell study. As we noted at the top of the show, that debate's going on again and again, and it's fascinating. That's not really the word I would use, but interesting nonetheless to now watch the left argue for more inclusion into the war rather than arguing for an end to the war and wars of aggression and the war of terror based on lies, based on terror events which we know very little about, that have the fingerprints of intelligence networks, as they always seem to do. So those were our war horrors, our occupations, and our electrodes, and our color-coded propaganda, and our Blackjack Friday, and our Portland tree bomber, and all our related stories. We're going to take a quick break, a little musical interlude, if you will, with a band that I'm going to go check out tonight here in Portland, Oregon, at the Aladdin Theater, opening up for the book's Black Heart Procession. Did you wonder? All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. That was music from the Black Heart Procession from their 2002 record, Amor del Tropico. And we're now well into hour number two here of episode 197. It's December 3rd, 2010. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com, your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies and cover-ups, all that and so much more. It can't be summed up with a little simple catchphrase. But of course, it's time now to dive into Cablegate. WikiLeaks unveils secret State Department cables. And as was being joked about on the latest episode of No Agenda, cables? One of these telegrams? In the main site they have set up for this, cablegate.wikileaks.org, a vast treasure trove of secret State Department cables obtained by the website WikiLeaks has exposed the inner workings of U.S. diplomacy, as well as bluntly candid assessments by American diplomats, according to news organizations granted advance access to the more than 250,000 confidential documents. The documents suggest U.S. diplomats were ordered to engage in low-level spying by obtaining foreign diplomats' personal information, such as frequent flyer and credit card numbers, presumably to better track their movements. The cables also expose the sensitive diplomacy involved in winning sanctions against Iran, U.S. officials' attempts to remove highly enriched uranium from Pakistan, and new information on how North Korea is believed to have aided Tehran's weaponry program, giving it advanced missiles that could allow it to strike Moscow and major Western European cities. So, of course, this is one of those stories that has no shortage of coverage. This has been the story of the past week, which should always make you wonder maybe what else is going on. But we've got related links to oilprice.com, as well as The Guardian and Danger Room, and the Washington Post, and Talking Points Memo. We also have some fascinating and interesting related WikiLeaks updates. WikiLeaks Cablegate site hit by powerful cyber attack. The WikiLeaks website said it came under a forceful internet-based attack on Tuesday morning, making some of the content, including the controversial Cablegate documents, inaccessible for hours to users in the U.S. and Europe. The site appears to have responded by switching its main hosting base from Sweden to the U.S., making it available again. On Tuesday, traffic to the site went to Amazon.com Incorporated server for rent service based in the U.S. The site, which distributed a trove of U.S. diplomatic documents on Sunday, said in a Twitter message on Tuesday morning that it was under a distributed denial of service attack, DDoS, a method commonly used by hackers to slow down or bring down sites. WikiLeaks didn't identify the hackers. Interestingly enough, and what's not noted in there from CBS, Amazon immediately, very quickly stopped hosting WikiLeaks. More on that from FCW.com. But more from a former Pakistani general. He notes and claims that the CIA and Mossad are behind WikiLeaks reports. Former Pakistani Army commander said that the disclosure of classified documents by the whistleblower side of WikiLeaks is a U.S. plot to create rift among friendly and neighboring states. And he is, of course, not the only one noting that or questioning that or positing that possible alternate reality to what we see going on right now on the world stage, that somehow this pale Swedish guy is the most powerful muckraker in the world. Interpol has put a red notice on Assange calling for his arrest. More on that from The Guardian. Hillary Clinton perhaps being one of the worst battered in these leaks, again, as it relates to the State Department. That's her baby. Assange said Hillary should resign. Sydney Morning Herald reporting yesterday, police close in on Assange. And this is the soap opera going on right now. Are they just prepping the world for the announcement? Two in the head. And they capped him. is WikiLeaks some type of cutout? Are they being fed information that help the grand chessboard? Those are the questions we should ask about any media organization, let alone one that has become this massive and this seemingly all-important. Over these past few WikiLeaks, over the last year with collateral murder and the Afghanistan war logs and the Iraq war logs and now Cablegate, question is, who benefits? Key Bono. That's the question. Who benefits from this type of revelations, if you can call them revelations, that Sarkozy's thin-skinned and other basically catty remarks from diplomats? Is this being used to bring an attack on the web? Could this be just sidestepping some sort of I-9-11 event, a punch in the Facebook, as we call it, on cyberspacewar.com, that catalyzing catastrophic event that will let them shove an I-Patriot Act down our throat? Perhaps they're sidestepping that a little bit, and they'll go for WikiLeaks because of the massive damage done to the great credibility and stature of the Western military-industrial complex that we have to take massive steps to stop these kinds of leaks. That, again, of course, just trace back to the military, as, again, most of these things do. Almost always an inside job in one way or another. Lieberman introduces anti-WikiLeaks legislation. That's from Threat Level, and we've noted in the past several months that Lieberman wants a Chinese-style internet. He has said it. They can do that in China. We should be able to do that here. He wants the kill switch. And they're just codifying it. They're just retroactively making it legal for the things that they're doing and have done and are planning on executing. Our last WikiLeaks note, as again, we're not going to spend a ton of time on this. This is one of those stories that, again, you can flesh out easily on your own, as there's no shortage of coverage. But from shtfplan.com, WikiLeaks to target and bring down major financial institution. An interview with Assange and Forbes. They ask him, you've been focused on the U.S. military mostly in the last year. Does that mean you have private sector focus leaks in the works? Yes. If you think about it, we have a publishing pipeline that's increasingly linearly an exponential number of leaks. So we're in a position where we have to prioritize our resources. Blah, blah, blah. Yes. We have one related to a bank coming up. That's a mega leak. It's not as big a scale as the Iraq material, but it's either tens or hundreds of thousands of documents, depending on how you define it. Is it a U.S. bank? Yes, it's a U.S. bank. One that still exists? Yes, a big U.S. bank. The biggest U.S. bank? No comment. When will it happen? Early next year. The speculation is that it's about Bank of America, B of A, B very of A. And again, could that be the type of catalyzing catastrophic event to get further financial clampdowns going in the new financial world order in our North American community here? But let's get some of our related geopolitical updates, and we'll take it cautiously from Debka.com. A nuclear scientist killed in Tehran was Iran's top Stuxnet expert. Professor Majid Shahriri, who died when his car was attacked in North Tehran Monday, November 29th, headed the team Iran established for combating the Stuxnet virus rampaging through its nuclear and military networks. We noted some of the latest Stuxnet developments on cyberspacewar.com. An even more interesting note on the grand chessboard, Bloomberg reporting Nigeria will file charges against former U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney and officials from five foreign companies, including Halliburton, over a $180 million bribery scandal. A prosecutor at the anti-graft agency said indictments will be lodged in a Nigerian court in the next 3 days. Godwin Abla, prosecuting counsel at the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission, said in an interview, an arrest warrant for Cheney, quote, will be issued and transmitted through Interpol, end quote. We can dream, can't we? And our last geopolitical note, as we made reference to before, with the pop culture meme that Han shot first. However, South admits firing first shells in their row with North Korea.
South Korea has admitted it fired artillery shells that triggered an early morning clash with North Korea. However, it says it was part of a military drill and denied it was directed at the North. Earlier, Seoul blamed the North for what it called a non-provoked shelling of its island. Pyongyang claimed the South had violated its maritime border during the military drills. Seoul has since threatened its neighbor with what it calls enormous retaliation. Russia's foreign ministry said the clashes were unacceptable and called on both sides to show restraint.
What happened deserves condemnation. We insist that both sides must take measures to pacify the situation and prevent similar action in the future. Unfortunately, this is already the third incident of the kind this year. But this time, there's a colossal danger of the situation descending into military conflict. This must be avoided. Russia has repeatedly warned of the growing tension in the region and is now counting on both sides to arrive at a suitable conclusion.
Well, Pavel Lechakov from the Moscow State University told RT the international community is prejudiced against the North and is ready to blame it for everything with little evidence.
Even if we take the previous case of Cheonan warship, so the conclusion that it was the blame of Northern was taken with not so much evidences. And if you take just the UN statement on this matter, they don't mention exactly North Korea. But still, I think 80% of articles of media is still blaming North Korea for this episode.
South Korea shot first. Another powder keg situation going on in the world. The grand chessboard, if you will. And that's the close of our related geopolitical grand chessboard updates posted up at the bottom of Cablegate. WikiLeaks unveils secret State Department cables. And in the rush to make sure I cover everything, I did have a clip covering WikiLeaks. So let's go back and pick up the change.
Finally, it is for the world to see. WikiLeaks has put out 220 confidential documents of the U.S. State Department that show how the U.S. seeks to safeguard its influence around the world. A quarter of a million American documents. That's what we're talking about. They originate from almost every flashpoint on the map. They lay bare the actions, habits, and misdeeds of world leaders from Afghanistan to Iran, Pakistan, Libya, Russia, and many others. These unflattering portraits will provoke negative reactions and possibly even a breakdown in ties. It is the truth behind the fake diplomatic smiles. It's an unprecedented look at backroom bargaining by U.S. embassies around the world. And now let's take a look at what's come out today and what more is expected over the next few days. Remember, these diplomatic cables between the State Department in Washington and about 270 American embassies and consulates across the world give us unhindered insight.
So as long as we're cleaning up the Cablegate leavings there. We also want to note that it is interesting that, as we had reported to you in previous weeks, that Scandinavian countries, one by one, were pointing the finger at the U.S. for spying on them. Sweden and Norway both. Then, days later, we have this Cablegate. Just adding it to the pile. So let's not get confused. And that closes out our Cablegate geopolitical grand chessboard coverage. And we're going to move now for the remainder of the show to the 12-2 News Purge. Watch us explode. The December 2nd News Purge, named for our opening track from the Polyphonic Spree, Watch Us Explode, only has a few areas to go through on this News Purge. As you may generally know, longtime listeners know, it's a generally a massive list of headlines. But things have been quite busy with life and work and holidays and a cold. But you know, there's always so much in the pipeline. Again, our interview last week with Harry Sweeney, my appearance on groundzeromedia.org with Clyde Lewis on KUFO. And you may also notice that we're just a few short weeks away from the 200th episode of MediaMonarchy.com. So now, having said all that, let's get into the news purge, and we'll start it with econo crash updates. Iceland faring better than Ireland after they just let their banks fail. Iceland's president, Grimson, said his country's better off than Ireland thanks to the government's decision to allow the banks to fail 2 years ago and because the krona could be devalued. The difference is that in Iceland we allowed the banks to fail, Grimson said in an interview with Bloomberg. These were private banks, and we didn't pump money in them in order to keep them going. The state did not shoulder the responsibility of the failed private banks. That's the key. Ireland's Prime Minister Brian Cowan said this week his government had discussed an 85 billion euro, that's $112 billion bailout with the EU and IMF after the country's banks threatened to bring the euro member to the brink of bankruptcy. Iceland's banks, which still owe creditors about $85 million, were split to create domestic units needed to keep the financial system running while foreign liabilities remained within the failed lenders. As a consequence, Iceland is faring much better than anybody expected. How far can we ask ordinary people, farmers and fishermen and teachers and doctors and nurses, to shoulder the responsibility of failed private banks? That question, which has been at the core of the Ice Save issue, will now be the burning issue in many European countries. Now, the hot and cold language within there notwithstanding, it's interesting to note here, the president of Iceland noting, we didn't pump up private foreign banks with phony money and pass off the debt to our poor slaves. That's the difference. Bloomberg also reporting federal employee pay freeze proposed to control deficit. And I'm not sure, this is, you know, this swirls around all our little congressional critters. And the left is this, and the right does that, and it's all a dog and pony show. They are multi-generational serial killers and gangsters and banksters who want to keep the game going. Three-card Monty on the street corner. So this question's battling around, and this actually battles around and even concerns the food safety bill that due to a procedural snafu may be snafu'd. And we can hope. And again, we'll tell you, call your reps. It's easy. So this pay freeze surrounds the quote-unquote Bush tax cuts and, again, all of the yada yada. While it does seem that average folks get really angry at the partisan politics of why can't, you know, we can't get anything done, the other way to take it is we should be damn thankful that they're not getting much done. The less they do, the better off it's going to be for most of us, the average folks. USA Today reporting about 2 million Americans stand to lose their unemployment checks by the end of December after Congress failed to extend benefits Tuesday, threatening to crimp consumer spending in a fragile recovery and critical holiday shopping season. A motion by Senator Jack Reed, Democrat of Rhode Island, to pass an extension on a voice vote fell short. The National Employment Law Project, NELP, estimates extending benefits for a year would cost about $56 billion, but economists say they provide an outsized economic lift because the unemployed spend cash on necessities rather than socking it away. Interesting to note. The Federal Reserve released documents Wednesday identifying the recipients of $3.3 trillion in emergency aid provided at the height of the phony financial crisis, the controlled demolition, if you will. Two European megabanks, Deutsche Bank and Credit Suisse, were the largest beneficiaries of the Federal Reserve's purchase of mortgage-backed securities, Huffington Post is reporting. More than $290 billion worth of mortgage securities were sold to Deutsche Bank, a German lender. Credit Suisse, a Swiss bank, got more than $287 billion in mortgage bonds. The mortgage purchase program has come under withering criticism by economists and financial experts who believe the Fed's initiative has unnecessarily inflated the housing market and prevented the cleansing that pretty much all experts believe is necessary for a full economic rebound. In addition, the Fed disclosed details of swap arrangements with foreign central banks, the Associated Press reported. We'll also note that banks weren't the only recipients of Fed money. Corporations like Caterpillar, General Electric, Harley-Davidson, McDonald's, Verizon, and Toyota also relied on the programs. And we'll just mention Iceland again. And the too-big-to-fail phony mantra. Speaking of the Federal Reserve, we go to McClatchyDC.com. Fed wants to strip a key protection for homeowners. As Americans continue to lose their homes in record numbers, the Federal Reserve is considering making it much harder for homeowners to stop foreclosures and escape predatory home loans with onerous terms. The Fed's proposal to amend a 42-year-old provision on the Federal Truth in Lending Act has angered labor, civil rights, and consumer advocacy groups, along with a slew of foreclosure defense attorneys. They're not only asking the Fed to withdraw the proposal, they also want any future changes to the law be handled by the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which begins its work next year. We can hardly wait. Hundreds lined up in the Atlanta cold for help heating their homes. More on that from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, AJC.com. And those are the stories we're going to see a hell of a lot more of, unfortunately. A positive note, I think, from ABC News. More than 8 million consumers stopped using credit cards over the past year. The decline stems from a combination of consumer choices and bank actions. An analysis by credit reporting agency TransUnion found that use of general-purpose credit cards bearing MasterCard or Visa logos or issued by Discover or Amex fell more than 11% in the third quarter compared with the July to September period last year. About 62 million people now have an active card compared with 70 million 1 year ago. Cut up your credit cards. Cancel your cable subscriptions. Cancel your corporate media news subscriptions. Grow your own food, make your own media, put on your own plays, write your own stories, cut your own hair. These are the things that will be the revolutionary acts as these things progress. That's about as simple as I think we can put it. And those are the things we can do on our own every day in our own lives. Our last EconoCrash note links to endoftheamericandream.com as well as the economiccollapseblog.com, as we'll make a passing note to last Friday's Blackjack Friday chaos. And there are a lot of videos, and I've not watched a single solitary one of them because I don't want to and I don't need to. But apparently, Americans are willing to trample one another to get cheap, foreign-made plastic crap, even as the U.S. turns into a post-industrial wasteland. And that's our situation. Trampling each other for whatever latest gadget that has Elmo on it or whatever celebrity on it. And those are the things that don't put a lot of hope in your heart for positive outcomes as the elite force their agenda on us. They know we all want to tear each other apart. So whether it's over a Cabbage Patch doll at Christmas time, or you support some corporate candidate that I don't, and that means you're racist or that blah, blah, blah. These are the things we have to guard against. And I think, fortunately, a lot of folks are realizing that these holidays aren't about the corporate involvement that has trumped them up over the years. Most of these things date back to pagan eras and astrotheology. And a lot of them are a huge charade. I may have speculated last week. I can't help but wonder sometimes during these holiday situations as I see retail on the ground. Are we just following through? Is it like Dawn of the Dead? Going through the motions in the mall. So those are our Econo Crash updates. Oh, good Lord. Continuing on the news purge, we get to a little history mystery where, amazingly, 271 Picassos have turned up in France.
The revelation of these previously unknown works believed to be by famed painter Pablo Picasso has set off a legal battle. Retired French electrician Pierre Leganex says he worked for Picasso at three of his properties and that the artist gave him the works. At 71, Leganex decided he was getting on in years and contacted the administrators of Picasso's estate. They authenticated 271 works, valuing them at $79 million. Soon after, Picasso's son Claude sued Leganek, alleging illegal receipt of the works.
L'estimation très bas.
A lawyer for Picasso says it was a shocking moment to discover the unknown and unlisted Picasso creations. But he says it's impossible that Picasso could have made such a gift.
When Picasso made just a little drawing, a metro ticket, he collected it. He bought his own works at the end of his life.
The works come from Picasso's most creative period. Claude Picasso says his father always dedicated, dated, and signed his gifts, knowing that some might try to sell them. Leganek told the AP that he and his wife did nothing wrong. A French agency in charge of battling the illegal traffic of cultural items is holding the works, which were seized from the Leganek home last month. Matt Friedman, The Associated Press.
A retired French electrician and his wife came forward with 271 undocumented, never-before-seen works by Pablo Picasso, estimated to be worth at least $80 million. I think I've told you folks I subscribe with RSS feeds, and that's how I get most of my news, through a feed reader, and then I bookmark and put things in the context that they need to be. I subscribe to some of the news of the weird, because you'll find amazing things there. Yes, there's a lot of tabloid, silly garbage, but it's also the kind of interesting things that have a lot of the occult symbolism or a lot of the other bizarre media memes that go on. So I, for other fellow news hounds out there, I do recommend subscribing to some of the news of the weird feeds. But we'll hop across the pond for yet more not very shocking revelations from the Daily Mail. Fresh scandal for Swedish royal family after Nazi past of Queen's father is revealed on a TV documentary. Sweden's royal family, recovering from revelations of the secret affair the king enjoyed with a pop singer, has been thrown into fresh turmoil over the Nazi past of the Queen's father. Swedish TV4's investigative program Kalla Fakta has broadcast the first of a two-part documentary detailing how Queen Silvia's late father grew rich producing armaments in a factory stolen from the Jews. When she married in 1976, the Queen's German father, Walter Sommerlath, denied he had ever been a member of the Nazi Party. That fiction was exposed some years later by a Swedish newspaper, which proved he joined the movement in 1934. Earlier this year, Queen Silva spoke for the first time about it in a TV documentary in which she said he was not politically active and that the factory he ran produced toy trains and hair dryers, as well as parts for gas masks for civilians. She said she did not take the factory over from Jewish owners. Now, the revelations from Sommerlath, who was living in Brazil at the time he joined the Nazis and only returned to Germany on the eve of the war, have plunged the royals into a new crisis. Swedish investigative journalist Bossy Sean says, quote, "The truth about Queen Silvia's father, which she doesn't want to tell herself or her family, is that he joined Hitler's Nazi Party beginning on December 1st, 1934. Also, Queen Silvia's father worked during his time in Brazil for the German company Arcos Berderes do Brasil LTD, which used wartime prisoners as slave labor in Nazi Germany. More documentation of our supposed elites, our self-styled leaders with their inbred families and their war criminal connections. And our last history mystery note is a bizarre one, but of course these things always swirl around the anniversary. Lee Harvey Oswald's coffin's up for sale.
A gruesome piece of history is hitting the auction block today. A funeral director in Fort Worth is auctioning off Lee Harvey Oswald's first coffin. Oswald, a man who shot and killed President John F. Kennedy in 1963, was buried in the coffin for 18 years. But in 1981, it was dug up as part of an effort to put conspiracy theories to rest that he was not really buried there. Bidding will start at $1,000, and the auction also includes Oswald's death certificate, an Easter card he sent to his brother, and a second of the car seat on which President Kennedy was sitting when he was killed.
What she meant to say was a section of the car seat on which Kennedy was sitting when he was killed, and any of those angles you could take and do a whole line of investigation and research about the car, and of course it got shipped off to Ford to get rebuilt, and they of course covered up the bullet holes in the windshield. And of course these things swirl around the anniversaries just coincidentally. Finally here on this 12-2 News Purge, watch us explode. We get to the media and the memes, which contain so many other things. A little murder and mayhem and police state action. Actor Mark Ruffalo added to terrorism watch list over the film Gasland. Actor Mark Ruffalo, who you may know from one of my favorites, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, has been reportedly placed on a U.S. terror advisory list after campaigning in support of a documentary highlighting the alleged dangers of natural gas drilling. Ruffalo attracted the attention of Pennsylvania's Office of Homeland Security when he organized screenings for the film Gasland, which won the special jury prize at this year's Sundance Film Festival, and said he was concerned about the impact of drilling on water supplies. The actor has addressed the subject in the latest edition of the American magazine GQ. Gasland, directed by Josh Fox, follows the filmmaker as he visits communities in Pennsylvania where natural gas has been drilled. Fox decided to document his trip after a national natural gas company wrote to him in 2008, offering to lease his family's lands in Milanville, Pennsylvania for $100,000. The documentary attracted attention for a particular scene in which a local man shows that he's able to set his tap water on fire. And they show it. Others claim they're suffering from numerous health issues due, they believe, to their water having been contaminated. Gasland has been fiercely opposed by the natural gas industry. A pro-oil and gas organization, Energy In Depth, has published a list of claimed factual inaccuracies in the documentary. And I'll just remind you, when we went over it on the previous 196B episode here on MediaMonarchy.com about the contaminated water currently in D.C., and of course, generally all around the country, with arsenic and mercury and radioactive materials and pharmaceuticals. Almost makes fluoride seem like the least of the worries. In response to all this, Mark Ruffalo has written a piece on HuffingtonPost.com, When Truth is Scarier Than Fiction, and he includes his Twitter address at the bottom, and I started to follow him there, mruff221. So, the last thing we'll note, and it's important to note, that Mark Ruffalo is also a 9/11 truther. So, if they were questioning with the amazing Pennsylvania police state activities that, of course, we reported to you several months ago with the involvement of Israeli corporations spying on American citizens, if they weren't sure with Ruffalo's connection to Gasland, I'm sure his 9/11 skepticism pretty much put the last nail in that coffin. a million library books to be sent down the mines. This is one literally down the memory hole. And these, you know, these are the stories that make it all worthwhile. 1 million books from Manchester Central Library, including valuable volumes dating back to the 15th century, are to be put into temporary storage, with many going deep underground in the Cheshire salt mines. Works from the city's reference library will be stored in the mines hundreds of feet below ground for the next 3 years, while the landmark city center site undergoes a massive refurbishment to save it from ruin. Experts say the mine's caverns, the size of about 700 football pitches, provide the perfect environment for preserving the manuscripts, which include the works of eminent academics. Books down the memory hole. I'm sure they'll bring them back soon. FreedomsPhoenix.com reporting on U2 and the concert No Warmest Would Applaud, quoting Bono on his bragging about U2's 360 Degrees tour in Melbourne in 2010. Bono said it's the most expensive rock spectacle ever. The tour, with a daily running cost of $850,000, arriving on 6 747 jets. You compare a tour by the number of trucks they use. The Rolling Stones ran 46. We're running 55. This is the biggest, said production manager Jake Berry. I don't want to put words in the amazing Bono's mouth and besmirch his amazing character. But we're getting our media and memes all mashed up together. The Chronicle Herald.ca reporting Nazi concentration camp survivor and then later horror film star Ingrid Pitt has died at the age of 73. Someone you probably do know, on the other hand. The Naked Gun himself, Leslie Nielsen, dies at the age of 84. More on that from the BBC. And interestingly, from HindustanTimes.com, and I only changed it to that because originally I believe I had Perez Hilton, and I wasn't going to link to that site. Throwing another reference to Perez Hilton was no agenda, making that reference to the WikiLeaks Cablegate. That's a bunch of catty Perez Hilton blog talk. But again, from HindustanTimes.com, Italian filmmaker Mario Monicelli jumps to his death at the age of 95. So there's three: Mario Monicelli, Leslie Nielsen, and Ingrid Pitt. We, of course, noted last week that our own winning stat, one of the big philanthropists here in Portland, their name graces many theaters and museum spaces around the city, committed suicide. Harry Potter grave becomes tourist site in Israel. And it's not from The Onion. This is from allgov.com. And no, not that Harry Potter. This Harry Potter of Birmingham, England, served in the British Army and was stationed in Israel, where he was killed at the age of 18 on July 22, 1939, during an ambush by anti-colonial Arab rebels. Despite not being the fictional hero of J.K. Rowling's enormously successful novels, Potter's grave in the Commonwealth Cemetery of Ramla has become quite the tourist attraction, thanks in part to the local tourist board's promotion of it. And we'll close off our media and memes with a dash of the murder and mayhem on this 12-2 news purge. Watch us explode with a follow-up to a story that, again, we touched on last week in our in-studio interview with H. Michael Sweeney of Pro Paranoid Press, the Star Whackers. We discussed the Randy Quaid situation in a good bit of detail. And I'm not sure we discussed the murder of Ronnie Chasen, which we did report for you here a couple of weeks ago. The publicist killed in what appeared to be a professional hit. A grisly update to this story that we get from CBS Local as well as ABC News. Man possibly linked to publicist murder commits suicide. Meanwhile, neighbors say that now deceased suspect bragged about killing famed Hollywood publicist Ronnie Chasen.
Our top story on CBS2. New details are expected today about a person of interest who killed himself yesterday as police went to talk to him about the murder of Hollywood publicist Ronnie Chasen. CBS2's Kirk Hawkins is live in Hollywood where it all went down, and a look at what's next.
Sibila, right now we're live outside Harvey Apartments. We're on Santa Monica Boulevard near Wilton. And as you take a look behind me, you can see that investigators have left the scene. It appears that most of the residents of the building have been able to return inside as we wait for an update from the Beverly Hills Police Department. A van removed the body of a black man in his 40s last night. The LA County coroner says he has not yet been identified, pending notification of his family. Neighbors tell us that they knew him as Harold. Neighbors also say that Harold described himself as an ex-convict who served two sentences in prison for firearms and drug convictions. Beverly Hills police say he's a person of interest in the murder of Hollywood publicist Ronnie Chasen. The LA Times is reporting that he died after he shot himself in the head with a pistol inside the lobby of the Harvey Apartments. Detectives say they tried to serve a search warrant at 5:30 last night. At about that same time, residents of the building say they heard a single gunshot. Beverly Hills police say they've talked to him as a person of interest in the past. Detectives say what happened last night was a follow-up interview that turned deadly. Chasen's family members couldn't be reached last night, but a longtime friend says he hopes this will shed new light on her murder.
Ronnie was, you know, so likable, and she was a fun gal, and she was, you know, you're just thinking this didn't happen. There must be a different Ronnie Chasen.
The manager was a little uncomfortable about talking, telling us to come back later. Some other things that added up, and so when we returned from Home Depot about 2 hours later, obviously we put two and two together.
And I saw a bunch of stuff taped off inside, and there was a bike knocked over that was inside the lobby, and like four cops in there.
This person shot himself. It was a self-inflicted gunshot wound, pronounced dead later on, and the investigation is ongoing at this time.
And now take a look at this. This is what it looks like inside the complex this morning. Residents of the low-income residential hotel say the man lived there almost 9 months. The hotel is owned by Eric Geffen. Geffen is a Beverly Hills real estate owner. We've not been able to reach him for comment just yet. Residents say there are more than 100 rooms at the Harvey Apartments, and it's mostly short-term housing. Rates range from $600 to $700 per month. Now, former LAPD detective Mark Furman told The Hollywood Reporter that a professional hitman is unlikely to commit suicide or lead a trail for police just to knock on his door. Back out here live now at the Harvey Apartments, we're looking at the door of the lobby, the focus of the investigation, and now investigators, we're waiting for them to update us on this case. We still don't yet know if there's a connection between Ronnie Chasen and the person of interest. Live in Hollywood, Kirk Hawkins, CBS. Tune in.
The latest in that Hollywood murder mystery, publicist Ronnie Chasen shot to death in Beverly Hills a few weeks ago while driving home after a movie premiere. The police there have said repeatedly that the case is wide open, but last night, as they closed in on a potential suspect, he killed himself. Mike Von Friend is in Los Angeles with more. Mike?
Good morning, George. Beverly Hills detectives confronted a Hollywood man they discovered as a person of interest in the murder of Ronnie Chasen, the powerhouse publicist. And when he was confronted in the lobby of his hotel, he shot himself with a handgun.
Beverly Hills police are calling the man a person of interest in this sensational mystery, but are releasing no details. This father and son from Alaska, staying at the hotel, had a front row seat in an unfolding live episode of Law & Order. They saw the cops waiting for the man.
They were having conversations with the manager, ascertaining who, in fact, was here, where he might be.
It was most certainly dramatic.
They attempted to talk to the suspect. When they did, the suspect produced a handgun, and there was a self-inflicted gunshot wound at that point in time.
Ronnie Chasen was one of Hollywood's most elite publicists, and the interest in who may have wanted her dead is off the charts.
The investigation is ongoing at this time. We've got nothing further to disclose about the investigation.
But police sources tell ABC News that the first thing they will do is a ballistics test to see if the gun used in the suicide is the gun that killed Chasen. And won't say yet how the dead man was connected to the shooting. But as we reported earlier this week, one thing's for sure, the shooter knew what they were doing.
This is something that's done, you know, with some skill. And I'll be honest with you. I carried a gun for 38 years and had to qualify quarterly. I don't know that I could shoot, you know, at that.
Today, police are investigating someone who may have had a much closer relationship with the victim. The latest details have this movie-making capital on edge.
have the Hollywood star whacker struck again. Now, did you catch the mention of the name of the man who owned the apartment building that our now deceased suspect lived in? That last name was Geffen. The LAPD running ballistic tests on the gun a suspect in the Ronnie Chasen murder used to kill himself. They want to see if the gun matches. Ronnie Chasen was killed on November 16th. The film she had worked on, Burlesque, had just opened. And what's really going on here? We don't know. We were just noting in the chat room on ZeroPointRadio.com, was that part of his programming? Did someone call him up and say, why don't you pass the time by playing a game of solitaire? Those are the questions we're not going to be able to answer, my friends. Those are the questions swirling around the Hollywood star whackers and the murder and mayhem and the media and the memes. That closes out the 12-2 news purge. Watch us explode. And in the remaining few minutes here on episode 197 of MediaMonarchy.com, we want to hop over to Twitter.com/MediaMonarchy, where, as we've noted over the last several weeks, because I got a new Wi-Fi pod, our Twitter feed has been exploding, and we're using it just as another tool, another bell and whistle to get this information out to folks. Let's scroll through our Twitter.com/MediaMonarchy feed to get some of the other related updates on stories that maybe we covered on these episodes and maybe we didn't. And again, that's why there's no one source that has all the news. Not the show, not the site. It spills out all over the place. So just as I was preparing to take a long winter's nap last Friday night, as generally after I do these shows and do all the post-production and all the uploading and all the editing and all of those things, I like to go to sleep and maybe not pay attention to the news for 12 or so hours. But no, not last Friday night, Blackjack Friday night. Wouldn't you know it? Oregon terrorist, apparently a rapper jihadi wannabe fitness guru set up by the FBI and is now known as the Portland Tree Bomber. We also note from World Mind, no gun shall ever be naked again, for Leslie Nielsen has passed away. Signs of the Times reporting on the Oregon mosque attended by Mohammed, targeted by apparent arson. I tweeted live from Ground Zero on KUFO with my man Clyde Lewis of GroundZeroMedia.org, again discussing the Portland Tree Bomber and the face of error. At Breaking News, reporting on a man fatally shoots himself in Hollywood as cops serve search warrant in slaying of publicist Ronnie Chasen. Raw Story reporting on Obama White House pressuring Spain to drop Bush torture prosecution. That's something that came out of Cablegate. U.S. diplomats took marching orders from the CIA on UN spying. That comes from Cablegate. Feds warrantlessly tracking Americans' credit cards in real time. We went over that on cyberspacewar.com. Here's a good update on the tree bomber situation, and this would probably be the latest I could give you. From the Portland Tribune, Commissioner Dan Saltzman backs away from terrorism task force proposal. Portland City Commissioner Dan Saltzman has decided against recommending Portland join the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force, which our city and the mayor at the time, Potter, declined collusion with the Joint Terrorism Task Force, probably because it was being run by the Bushies and they didn't trust them. Now the fear is that there's Democrats and a shiny, happy face on our police state tyranny, that they were going to use this tree bomber patsy event to get Portland back in the task force. We're hoping that's not going to happen. And again, that's another phone call that needs to be made. Consortium News notes, WikiLeaks exposure is a full body scan for the U.S. empire. That's a nice little meme for you there. And so those are just some of our latest tweets on Twitter.com/MediaMonarchy. Again, tons of ways to get this information out. And if you use Twitter which some folks love it, some folks don't. Some folks are more Facebook, some folks are more Twitter, some folks are more YouTube. Whatever you like, Media Monarchy will be there putting out this open source intelligence and alternative news. Let's make one reference to creepy customers coming to MediaMonarchy.com. In the past week, we had Forbes Incorporated out of New York City. They were reading a story from a couple years back that, again, relates to the recent JFK assassination. CIA continues to stonewall release of JFK assassination files. Longtime listeners may note the creepy customers that we do at the end of the episodes come from statcounter.com, and if you put basically a feed counter on your website that shows I've had X amount of hits, it gives you the back-end tool to look at who's visiting your site. Anymore, it's become a lot of just residential, and that just means it's average people getting this news. As we noted, Yahoo's biggest search term for the year was the BP oil spill, the first time it's ever been a news story, taking the number one slot. People are interested. That's what it's about. We were generally using the stat counter to track all the interesting corporate governmental visits, but those seem to be becoming less. And again, MediaMonarchy.com is your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. If you find this information valuable, please hit the donate button at the top of MediaMonarchy.com, and we will continue to get this information out, my friends. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com, reminding you, begging you, as always, don't hate the media. Become the media. Take care.
MediaMonarchy.com is your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. Featuring weekly radio shows on the Portland Radio Authority, PRAradio.org, the World Next Week video series with CorbettReport.com, plus special interview episodes, B-sides, mixtapes, and so much more. Send news tips to MediaMonarchy@gmail.com. You can make a donation or mail Media it to the Monarchy at P.O. Box 12165, Portland, Oregon 97212. Thanks to all the internet and community radio stations who broadcast these shows, and most of all, thanks to you. Remember, don't hate the media, become the media.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not go on with it, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.